Corregidor, and that didn't rest too well with most of the men, I don't believe.
Assess the effectiveness of the Japanese sniper, and how would you oppose that to the United States Marine Corps' sniper program in its infancy during the Second World War?
The Japanese were very effective with their snipers, and so far as the Marine Corps goes, it was in its infancy at the beginning of, this happened right in the very beginning, and they used the 03, I remember, and cut down with the telescopic sights, and that was a kind of a novelty to us, but that's about the extent of it.
How do you rate the effectiveness of the Navy corpsmen on Guadalcanal, and how would you rate them overall?
I could not give any higher rating in my mind to any unit or any people performing than what I would give to the corpsmen. They were just absolutely great. Rank was major at that time, so that's what he was. And the gold oak leaf was very, very shiny. I remember that, and I remember the voice. And I didn't, on the first inspection he pulled, I had, for an example, my belt had to be redone. It wasn't up to par the way it should have been. And so that there is, but I remember that, and he said something to me, this is really very good here, because I was 17 at the time, and I had fuzz on my face, and he said, "Son, don't you think you ought to shave that fuzz off?" And so, of course, you answered, "Yes, sir," because you're being inspected by a high-ranking officer along with the other, with your company commander and with your platoon leader, you know, your lieutenant and so forth. So that is something there that I think. And then there was another one that was regarding Chesty. I believe that I could do a little better job on it. Do you remember what your second question was about Chesty?
Your first impression, true to the impressions of him as a combat leader?
No, I think mostly what I saw was that he was not, it appeared to be, afraid of anything. And when you saw him, he was never, he was always out in the open. And I had no way to think of that. And when I know when bullets was flying around, I was behind a rock or anything, I could behind a tree or something.
Right.
But he never seemed to be afraid of anything. And that was the one thing that stood out beyond anything else. I personally observed that, as the other ones did. And I even would go so far as to say that some of the people even tried to copy that. You know, some of your leaders tried to, you know, like, I remember Lessie was he never seemed to act like too afraid. And it looks good. It looks very, very good in combat for the people to do that. But I never could get in the mood of the whole thing myself of trying to do a thing like that. But there was some who did. And I think that that they tried to copy off the thing off of Chesty. But the one thing that I later on found, in fact, I got that from that tape about him, was he was a Christian man. And he believed, they said that about Stonewall Jackson, that he was very, history tells us that he was very much a Christian person.
Mm-hmm.
And that Chesty was also, he was very much a Christian person. And he believed that the good Lord, in a way, would protect him.
Right.
And that comes out in this, where they do this tape on him here. And I believe that that could have very well been part of his, what would you say, mystique?
Right. Don't you think that maybe, like, some of the things that made him so endearing to the enlisted men and, you know, to the grunts in the mud might have hurt his career later on? I mean, his reliance and his dependence on the non-commissioned officers and privates and his trust in them?
I don't think he depended on anybody. That's proven by one fundamental thing where he commandeered a destroyer and went in close to the shore at one time to get us out. And had he not have done that and blazed, he personally got on that 50 caliber. And actually, the story goes that I know nothing about this other than what I read, but that he was able to get us out where we were surrounded by Japanese. He got us out. He personally did this, so he wasn't afraid. And he's notorious for being his own, doing his own thing. He's notorious for that.
Right.
Of course, he was looking into, you know, a great many instances. Sims was our regimental commander, Colonel Sims. He was a full-bird colonel at that time. I remember him on this at canal when I first got there. And he was lieutenant colonel, so he had the maple leaf, silver maple leaf. And so he had to fall within whatever the command said to do. And I remember that one instance, for an example, Into the Valley, there's a book written about that. And he saw a bright, you know, the burning ashes in a fire there. And I was within distance. I actually personally observed that. I could see them, but I couldn't see whether they were hot or not. But the story goes that they were. And he tried to stop us from going on into the next, this next big hill there.
Mm-hmm.
And Sims said, no, we'll go on. So that was a good example.
Fuller knew that the Japs were only a couple hours
away. Yes, he knew by that.
Point.
He knew there's something wrong because there was hot ash in there. And that had that fire, I would have had to have been there sometime before. So I think that was a very good example of his advice and so forth. But it wasn't heeded because Sims said, well, we got to go to the next hill. So, and actually there was, I'd say there was lives lost as a direct result of that. Because Into the Valley was one of the greatest ambushes that was ever pulled on the canal, and we were actually hit hard.
Right. It's one of like textbook sniper assaults.
Yeah.
I mean,
they were. That's true. In fact, when I think about this, Steve, I don't know of anything for the duration of time when it happened. That, see, I was personally involved in this way. I was the assistant B Army.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, machine gun in the line, you know, machine gunners, pass the word back, you know, there's no way of getting it, but pass the word, you know, and you hear this. And I think my mind, I don't know what I thought of really then, but I think I could have conceivably been thinking, well, when is it going to be me? Because I know that I've got this extra ammunition. I've got 240 rounds, I believe, is what I'm carrying in addition to supply that B Army. So, of course, when they call a B Airman, they call the assistants, too. Assistants. So when they said the B Airman and assistants forward. So when we got forward, we went and passed all these other guys. And, oh, how you wish that you could be one of them guys in that line, you know, there. You wish to hell because you're going right into it now.
Right.
And of course, these machine guns have been cracking off for quite a little while now. And you think, my God, we don't know what the hell's going on, but it's got to be something, you know. You know, all this shit. And so we go up there, and I don't know, sometimes this stuff kind of breaks me up a little bit, guys. But anyway, we got up there. We go down the same steep hill, you know. We get down in there. Well, we finally figured out we got to get the hell out of there because, you know, they're getting us, and it's late in the evening. So we got to climb this goddamn hill, you know, shit. But that night, this whole hillside was covered. We put our wounded, we had to put our wounded in the middle, see. And we're around the outer edge like this, digging a hole and protecting our wounded from dying. So we got mopped up good there. We got the shit kicked. If you wanted to call it falling back for a better position, so be it, but we sure as hell got our asses out of there after a while because we were losing badly. And there were several times we did it. Had to. Best get killed. Well, Chesty, you know, got it himself. At one point, I used to say that. At one point, I remember when Muggsy got it. Muggsy had this name because he, you know, his face was just like flattened out, like if you hit him with a flat Pan or something like that. Your nose was down and everything. That's how I got that name, Muggsy. But he was my VR. And I'm his assistant, you see. So I remember Kirby Smith, he said, come up on the line there. He said, Fox. He said, follow me. So I went up there. And Muggsy was laying there dead. He got shot through the top of the head. There was some real things like that. You know, it's hard to hold your composure and talk about these things. It'll always do with you. Mm-hmm. As long as you've got blood in your body. What a hell of a place. And when I got Dan, you know, your brother Dan, tried to, and I did, but it wasn't, I could never really take the credit. I think it was George that threw it in. He got it in, he said, Dan, he said, you know, of course I had listened to George, I told George, you try to talk to him, I said, I don't know anything right before, I said, he goes in. At that time, it was a very good chance that he would have, but he was really done the whole way, remember that? Yeah. If he goes over there, I said, I don't know. It wasn't, it didn't have nothing to do with the fact that Dan would have been an excellent Marine. I know that. But that wasn't the point. He'd even go in a lot of other branches of service and probably have a much better chance of surviving. Because at that night, at that time, if he went in, I guess probably Korea, wouldn't it, Walt?
Yes, no, it
was not. Was it not? That's right, he is a non. There was an awful lot of shit going on. And I have read of other examples that, you know, I just reading about things that happened where I was not participating in. Boy, I mean, you know, some awful stuff that happened, an awful lot of dead people. But I was young, hell, I was on the canal when I was 18 years old. 18 years old. I went in when I was 17, but I was on the canal when I was 18. I went in September. That's how long it took him to get, how long it took to get me over where it was hot. I went in September, about September the 22nd, I believe, September
the 22nd. Did they accelerate boot camp or something for you guys, knowing? Because, I mean,
not at that time, I don't think they did. I think we went through pretty much the whole
thing. T-72 just like me.
It wasn't too much longer, you know, after... because it was right after Easter, and that we went over. And he's over there September the 7th was the initial landing on the canal, 1st and 5th. And we came in, I think, 3 weeks later. We came in on August, rather, August the 7th, and we came in on it was August the 7th initial. So we came in September. It'll be probably more like maybe a month or so. But there wasn't, they actually had made the initial contact. There wasn't too much the commander there. He had some problems with it. In fact, when they left New Zealand, the 1st and 5th, when they got, they had to reload. Because they had, with their supplies, they had to rearrange the supplies to get, the first thing that's got to come off is munitions. Your ammunition is certainly holds a top priority. So when they load the stuff in holes, you know, they go down in the ship, down the bowels of the ship. Mm-hmm. They're like, they got different floors. Hell, you're down in there maybe, three or four floors, maybe 50 feet down in there. You know, they got these different levels, and what they do is they bring this stuff out, and when they drop this net down in there, they load that up, you know, they're able to pull that, and then the guy's crane operator, he gets his signal from the guy down there, he can see him way the hell up there high, and they'll take him, pull that stuff up. But anyway, they had this all, this stuff was arranged in, and it wasn't arranged right, so they had to pull back to one of the islands, reload these damn things, which took time, but, they made the landing. Of course, the strange thing that actually happened was they met no resistance. They pulled out in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of them there. But they pulled out in the hills, so they were really quite surprised by that. But they didn't make any because he didn't have his division. He wanted to wait until he got his all division together. Well, we were on Samoa. So then there's where Doug come in at one point. They had a problem with this, what the hell's his name, Omar, that admiral? He was the one that kept on wanting to go back to Pearl Harbor to read.
Fletcher.
To Fletcher. They had a problem with Fletcher trying to get some boats, you know, to come in and get us. They only needed about three different, two or three, these transports. They were actually, Kaiser had what they call a conversion or something.
Mm-hmm.
They had Liberty ships, what they call them. And so then they contacted, believe it or not, Douglas MacArthur had ships that was under his command. And they tried to solicit him. And finally, there was this one other admiral that's very well known. He's, remember what his name was, Wilma? We talked about it before.
Nimitz or Coffee?
You had the people's under Fletcher, a couple other admirals. He, different ranking, but he was up there pretty high. But anyway, they got a hold of him, and he was finally the guy to come and got us. And they had to initiate somebody to go to Samoa and pick up the 7th Regiment. 7th Marines, which is us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they got us in there. So they saved that till that time and got the 7th Regiment in there. And then when they got the 7th in there, well, then he had his division. See, he had his 1st Marine Division, all of his division. And when that happened, then, I mean, this guy's a hell of a great leader.
That's Nimitz.
No, Nimitz was the admiral. Oh, hell. What the hell is his name? Well, I can't. It's like... I want to say McIntyre, but it's not McIntyre. Seems like it starts with an I, don't it? It's stupid, you know, because... No, I'm talking about the leader of the Marine Corps.
Vandegrift,
Jesus Christ. Vandegrift, we had a great we had a great governor. The state of Michigan was named Vandegrift.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his name was Vandegrift. He's a big man of the division commander, Vandegrift. And in the early days, he was one-star general, I think. At the time, I think he was one-star. He was, well, a hell of a good man. They've got pictures in there showing this guy, Vandegrift. But now, I may have seen him at some point or other, but I don't recall it. I mean, in the Corps, they were very, very hard on this discipline, and you really didn't have, if you didn't have some purpose to see a high-ranking man like that, you more or less didn't have no business, you know.
Right.
Even Chesty, you'd see Chesty, but, you know, he's a big man, no question about it, so you don't go up and say, "How you doing there, Chesty," or something like that. You don't do that. He's too big. That's why, like I say, this happened. Hell, I was in this long line, and he was over, like, from about here to the garage away. I could see him with this long stick, and he's fooling around there, and Sims was there with him. And of course, we knew knew those people here, and he was fooling around that stick. And I had no way of knowing at that time. I know later on that, according to the book, it said that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I go by that, but I couldn't have seen hot ash at that distance. They said that it was actually hot ash in there, so... But another interesting thing was that when Halsey, see, Nimitz was really huge. I mean, he is the big man. And Nimitz, he's headquartered in Pearl Harbor. And after December the 7th, though. I mean, he went over there after that point. But he appointed, of course, he's got contact with Washington and so forth. He appointed Halsey to run the South Pacific operation. And so after Halsey came in, I'm told, in fact, pretty much authoritatively that from the standpoint of talking to these people, you know, he would come in, and it was his orders. The Marine Corps came under his command, Halsey. And he's a big man, and so he would confer with Vandegrift as far as the operation going, you know. Of course, he leaves naturally all that, but it's directly. And so things started to shape up a little bit better after Halsey got in there. But a lot of this stuff, see, as a little guy, I know I'm speaking after you learn these things, because there was no way for me to know at the time what was really going on. I didn't know. Sure, I knew about how I happened to learn about the sniper business and how many we had. One guy that had volunteered for the snipers, and I had seriously thought about it, and probably I would have joined in with it if one of the things I'd always liked would be the idea that, you know, you go in and do your own thing, you know, kind of like that. But I don't know if I would have or not, but I thought about it. But I didn't have a chance. They never asked me personally. And at the time, they'd lost a lot of lieutenants, you know, and so they were sending people back stateside. And that was really quite an episode there, too. I wish I'd been a high school graduate. I wasn't.
Send them back for officers' candidate school.
Yeah, to replace some of these lieutenancy, because I was losing the lieutenants left and right. Well, you know, the thing it was, I think, that the Japanese were, well, they were just like we were. I mean, they say that if you were a sniper and you saw the enemy, you would recognize probably who the leaders were, if they had any rankings or anything, and you probably popped them out first because they're more valuable. You know, you probably would have done that just with second nature.
Right.
And they were no different. They did that to our people, and so much so that people didn't want to be called any at whatever the rank was, the sergeant or whatever, and don't call me this or that. And just like I was saying, there's so many things that I recall, and a lot of things I don't recall. But the time I had ran into Chesty, and here he's just down there, you know, he's in the goddamn jungle. So I was going to go back and try to find or see anybody at all to give me permission to test fire this weapon, because I ain't got enough sense to know you just don't up arbitrarily on account of somebody figures you're the enemy's there, see. So they're going to get excited.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to excite a lot of people unnecessarily, because if you're testing, that's nothing. But if you're shooting at the enemy, that's something else. I mean, somebody might have come in. There may have been a dozen of them or so. Well, I saw Chesty back there. And I asked him, you know, to test fire that weapon. That's the one I was telling you about, that I should have listened to this instead of the other episode, you know. And I never thought about it, for God's sakes. At the time, I've said that, told that story several times. We just shooting the bull, and I said, but I can't figure out. I said, I never had thought about it that way, but Jesus Christ, I said, that was more important. I said, that's a bigger story, because that was in combat. But anyway, I saw Chesty, and I said, sir, could I test my weapon? And he says, no. He said, well, he says, you see Captain Buckley. He said, you go back here. He couldn't see the half track from where I was at. But he said, you go back here, and told me about generally where to go, you know. He says, you'll see a half track. He said, Captain Buckley's in that half track. And he said, you ask him. He said, yeah, he'll tell you. Okay, sir. Well, when I went back there, then I saw Captain Buckley. And that's the first J ration I'd ever had. And so he told me, he said, yeah, I said, you
have your piece, huh?
No.
Oh, it was a pure look better.
It was a pure mistake on my part to have ever, if I'd have been a little bit older, or if I'd have had somebody, if I had asked, I mean, somebody would have told me, you know, leave that something alone. I'm sure if Lessie would have known, he would have told me, you leave that damn thing, lay right there where it's at.
Right.
See? But I went ahead and picked it up on my own without, if there was somebody had a Tommy gun, they must have had a drum on there, because they fired more than 20 rounds. And that's another thing. Chesty told me, he said, don't worry about it. He said, they were taking care of me, see? Because I had to tell him what happened, see? So he got that much information out of me, and he said, well, I told him, I said, the three of them went to the front. He knew all about it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, they come down by the, I was on that part out there on the back part. So I must have exchanged several words with Chesty, you see, which is really, this is pretty hot shit. But like I say, here I'm not even thinking much about it. You know, here Chesty comes up. I never would have realized that, you know, anything about this kind of stuff. So the word that in place was is right. The ocean comes in, and this it's like a willow tree. It probably wasn't a willow, but it looks like a willow. And it had grown over. He was in the actually dipping some of the foliage was down in the ocean. These big waves are coming in and, you know, evening out. So it was about maybe a drop of, well, 3 or 4 feet, something like that, to where the top part of this this landmass was. Well, my hole was dug out right here real close by, right, in fact, real close to the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had looking back here and there and stuff, and the first thing that I noticed was kind of strange was there's an odor in the air. This was in the evening. And incidentally, it was after this little bit of thing I told you about trading for these coveralls.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that guy that's with the engineers was with the Army, and the Army had a tank in up there too, but he was the one I got this equipment from, and he had a pistol. Well, I could see this movement out here. Well, I had the damn BR against the tree, you see, leaning against the tree, and I had a cover over top of it, a shell casing to keep the water out.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of rain. And I jumped up. When I could, well, I couldn't at first. I just seen the movement. Of course, I don't know what it is. And this willow tree, you know, real dense foliage, you know, I could see this moving in there. But there's something. Well, then I saw one of them coming out. And they're dressed in such a way they don't have any shoes or anything on, see. So they could really run fast, which you do the same. Anybody else would do the same thing. He gets out there a little ways, and I see, before I can blink my eye twice, they're agile as hell, and two more of them popped out. And they're still only about from here across the garage away. Mm-hmm. They're that far. So I got up real fast. I had told him, I said, fire, fire, like this. And he, you know, he's looking this way. They're right there. So I jumped up and I got the damn BR, pulled it back again, about three times. And all I could just hear was a slush, a noise, nothing. And then I yelled real loud, and I said, you know, down the line there, thinking there'd be somebody in there. But really, the front would have been probably from here down there to the, well, I'd say that store, maybe a little bit further,
mm-hmm.
to where the actual front line had been formed there, you see. So it's quite a ways. Well, I had been further than that. But I yelled out, I said, fire, fire, fire. I remember, I think I said three times. But shortly after that, I noticed they started running a little faster after that noise, because they
you
knew what the hell that meant, see? And meanwhile, that damn Tommy gun, and it's funny, but I have no way to look at this in any way amusing at all, you know?
Yeah.
But they took off, damn Tommy gun kicking out, you know? Well, then, I had no way of knowing anything beyond that, you know, of course. We don't want to make no noise because that's what I was there for, because they said that we'd run past them and there's someone trying to escape back to the front to regroup. And so when I'd asked Chesty, he knew about that. He told me something wrong. He said, don't worry about it. He said, it's a guy with a Tommy gun. He said, God, I'll agree. But that's good. Yeah. And I was talking to Mr. Chesty for it right there. And, but I can't remember, thinking back, whether he was wearing his rank on him or not. You know, whether he'd had his things pulled off his shoulders or what. And, but I went on then and seen Buckley, and he gave me that J ration. And I come back, and I suppose I shared it with that guy, I don't know, because he wasn't there all the time. I didn't even actually have my assistant. They didn't. I guess they couldn't. At that time, I don't even know if I had one. I'm not aware of having an assistant, because this was in combat, and they need to, you know, work things around to figure out who the hell they're going to give you. as an assistant to help you carry some of this ammunition, you know. Or, of course, I was carrying normal, whatever the normal equipment would be, armed would be carrying. So I don't know how that would have worked out, of course. But somebody else could have easily been carrying, you know, additional ammunition you'd be needing. Rather bad period of time and so forth there. But I learned the lesson kind of late in life that you just don't go out and... Somebody apparently, they had to be our behind, had a field quartermaster there and for whatever. But it looked better than the one I had. The one I had didn't look very good. And I figured, well, shit, I'd get one that looks cleaner. Bad mistake. Until that summer just test fired, you don't know what the hell it is, what the hell that equipment is all about.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been, I cleaned it, but I'm sure it had a firing pin and everything in it. But that's not the whole picture, you know. Of course, there's something wrong.
Right.
Or he wouldn't have gotten rid of it. It wouldn't have been out there in the first place. Heard enough.